Hey guys, we have a Bankless Takes episode for you today on the docket. Is Ethereum changing its monetary policy again? Dun, dun, dun. Question for you, David. So there's this debate in the Ethereum community right now, and I've been paying attention to it, but a bit on the margins. I think you've been more directly paying attention to it. But it's a debate about changing the monetary policy of Ethereum, this holy ground we're treading in. Should we do it? Who gets to decide? What should the eventual monetary policy be? What's the context for this conversation?
Yeah, so two Ethereum Foundation researchers introduced a blog post, like a research blog post, proposing the idea of changing the monetary policy of ETH, changing the ETH issuance curve from what it is today to something else. Along with this research post came a proposal in alignment with the research post to include a change to ETH monetary policy for the next upcoming hard fork in Electra, which could be a hard fork as soon as the end of this year. And this expediency, this speed, created a ton of controversy and debate about the politics and optics of EF researchers rushing in a monetary policy change into the next hard fork. And this is something that some members of the Ethereum community had this like immediate negative reaction to. So really, in this debate that we're experiencing, that we're seeing in the Ethereum community, there's really like two pillars here. There is, should we change the ETH monetary policy? And then there's also like the much more controversial thing, which is like, what is the appropriate process for changing the ETH monetary policy? How fast should this be? How rushed should this be? I think in this episode today, Ryan, I actually kind of want to just focus on the monetary policy of ETH. There's the politics around the governance of Ethereum that I think the community and EF researchers and core devs will all kind of figure out. That's not really our realm. What I'm primarily interested in is, are we at the end game of ETH's monetary policy? And if not, what should we do about it? And that's the subject of today's episode.
Before we get into this episode, a quick shout out to our friends and sponsors over at Cartesi. What is Cartesi?
Cartesi is the first modular execution layer with a Linux runtime and real-world computing environment for Web3 devs. If that was kind of a mouthful to you, imagine running Doom as a layer two on Ethereum. So on-chain state with an on-chain gaming engine or anything else that like Linux can run. So you can boot up a Linux environment and leverage all of the like Linux developer ecosystem, code libraries, open source tooling, et cetera, that has been building around the Linux ecosystem. So you can do just a lot. You can do a lot with that, perhaps like literally infinity kinds of things with a Linux runtime on your chain. Cartesi is giving away $1 million in grants for their ecosystem, and this is now live. This is the call to action. So if you would like to apply to get some of that grant money, you can get up to $50,000 from Cartesi. There is a link in the show notes to get your grant applied.
They're giving it away, but you got to earn it. You got to go build something. That's the old-fashioned way, David. All right, should we get into the topic today?
Yeah, let's do it. But maybe we should, let's go like all the way back. Let's just like start at the very fundamental foundation of just like monetary policy. Ryan, what's monetary policy?
Monetary policy is how a entity kind of controls their money, right? And I would say that any money that has supply that is somehow impacted or arranged by human beings has a monetary policy associated with it.
Actually, so not gold. Gold, does gold have a monetary policy?
I would say it does. It's just like actually completely immutable perspective, right? Yeah. Unless we can find some way to do alchemy, which is eluded us through all of human civilization. But just gold is birthed in the aftermath of a supernova explosion, right? It's on the periodic table of elements. There's only a certain amount of gold in the universe. And so it's sort of derived its scarcity due to that. Everything else besides natural elements, even Bitcoin, even Ethereum, we'll get into it, and especially fiat currencies, they all have a monetary policy, which is just their issuance. How much of the supply are they issuing both now, in the past, and into the future? What would you add to that?
Yeah, I would say monetary policy, like on the human tech tree of like advances in technology, emerges sometime after both government and army. And so like armies, they protect a fiat currency, right? They enforce its value. governments like produce the actual monetary policy, and then armies give these governments power. And so like, it's a human controlled phenomenon. Policy implies some sort of like opinion about what money should be. And so I call it like relatively like a new phenomenon in the world. And then monetary policy really came into like its, you know, its like climax post leaving the gold standard, right? So like we had monetary policy while we were on the gold standard as the dollar, but it was really a matter of like how much fractional reserve are we okay with? Then once we went off the gold standard, we can like, all right, well, we now have complete and total control over the monetary policy of the US dollar. And so it's been this emerging thing alongside the role of like fiat currencies.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about that in the context of the different types of money that exist in a modern fiat-based economy. So a modern nation-state economy. And all of these are kind of like subject to manipulation because you just talked about that, the birth of government, the birth of sort of, paper money, getting off of, the gold standard, which had sort of an immutable monetary policy inherent in it. And there are like three, there's more than these, but the three areas of money that we could focus on are M0, M1, and M2. So money zero, money one, and money two. Money zero, maybe we should start there and do some quick definitions. So M0 is base money. What exactly is that?
I call base money almost like bare asset money. It's not a precise definition, but it's like kind of close. It's literally just like the raw underlying money of the whole economy, like literally printed dollars, and then dollars also held like digitally at the Federal Reserve. So this is like strictly currency in circulation plus commercial bank reserve balances inside of the Federal Reserve. It's like there's no deeper level other than M0. It's at like the basement level of currency.
And you said the Federal Reserve. So this is kind of, we're doing this mostly in US terms, of course. We're talking about the dollar as the unit of account here and the dollar being sort of the reserve currency for the world right now. It makes sense to talk about the Federal Reserve and the dollar specifically. So that's all of the physical cash that you see in the economy shrinking, I would say. There's not much physical cash in our daily usage. And it's also the banknotes that are held at the Fed, the commercial banknotes held at the Fed. And if we look at what that number is right now, this is monetary base, total monetary base since 1959. And you can kind of see this over time. So David, we are at about $5.8 trillion in M0 as of today. And you can see this chart. It's pretty steady up curve through the, the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and then whoa, what's this? 2008, what happened here? And we shoot back up, and like the last 14 years or so have been the spike upwards in terms of M0 liquidity as more cash is injected into the M0 economy.
Yeah, there's like two eras in this curve that really like stand out to me. There's the first era up to 2008, where like the slope is like pretty like linear, consistent, like regulated, dependable. And then 2008 happens, and then the curve is, at first it jumps up, as in like we added a lot of money supply into the world. But then it like kind of gets erratic and unpredictable, and you can kind of see opinions showing up in M0. You can see this is the Federal Reserve starts to be like, oh, you know what we can do? We can like leverage these levers. We can spin these dials a lot more than we have. This call kind of came into vogue in 2008.
You said opinions, but I'd go into more detail on those opinions. They seem like very short-term opinions. It seems like somebody is drunk on the levers and just like leaning into them, like jerking them one direction or another. It's much more jerky. Opinions were jerky. Expressed before this, but like they were very gradual. Right. Here's these incredible jerky ups and downs as far as M0, but always up. I'll note that always it's up. Almost always the long-term trajectory is up. So that is M0. What's the next M that we should consider?
We're going to talk about M1 and M2, but I just also kind of want to put a wedge between M0 and M1 that doesn't exist between M1 and M2. M1 is derivative money. And M2 is also derivative money. So like we're now, once you go beyond zero, you're into the world of derivative money. And really like M1, M2, M3, technically it keeps on going. It's like MN, like infinite number. But really, once you start to get beyond M3, it starts to get kind of foggy. M1, derivative money, first order derivative money is money like with a trusted intermediary. It generally includes the most liquid forms of money, things that are essentially money without actually being money that can quickly and easily be used for transactions. This is money held in commercial banks, savings held by banks and financial institutions. It's basically base money with a single order of intermediary between you, the user of M1, and base money. So like I would simply very call it like M1 is like first order derivative money. Very liquid, but just not as perfectly liquid as M0.
So the way this manifests to you is so M0, of course, is like a $20 bill in your wallet, okay? Mm-hmm. M1 yep. is the money in your savings account, your checking account in yep. Wells Fargo, right? That's
very,
what M1
very
is.
Accessible, but technically still subject to run on the banks.
Yeah, exactly. It's there, you know, PayPal, it's, you know, all of the digital money that you see in kind of like your own consumer personal savings account. That's sort of M1. It's kind of the stuff that we you know, like basically use today.
The point is that there's risk at M1 and there's zero risk at M0. Like with any sort of centralized trusted intermediary, there's insolvency risk, credit risk, theft risk. There's some sort of trust happening at the M1 layer, which is the meaningful differentiation between M0 and any other M, which is like there's a intermediary between you and anything above M0.
Right. I don't feel like we feel that trust anymore. Like it doesn't feel risky anymore because, you know, there used to be runs on the banks and things like this where your M1 is at risk and you better switch your bank. Now we have mm-hmm. FDIC insurance up to 250K. Right. And it seems like the Fed system will bail out any bank that like leads to insolvency. But I guess there is some risk here. One important point to note is this is a lot bigger in terms of M1 is a like it's much larger. It's kind of like another circle, outer layer, I would say. If just M0 is kind of the nucleus, M1 sort of surrounds it. We're looking at about $18 trillion of M1 right now.
Versus the $5.9 trillion of M0. And part of this comes from the fractional reserve layer of the commercial banks.
Exactly.
So like $1 in turns into like $10 out at the commercial banking layer. And so this is where we see like expansion of the monetary supply. Whereas the monetary base is at one number, the M1 number will always be some sort of multiplier on that because we live inside of a fractional reserve system.
So, David, if you thought the M0 chart was ridiculous with all of these ups and downs, look at the M1 chart here. And not much actually occurred in M1 supply in 2008, but something happened around 2020. And we see this absolutely like massive mountain cliff edge spiking upwards. What is that? What happened here?
Yeah, well, starting actually back at 2008, it's notable that M1 did not go down during 2008, even when, like, according to central bankers, we were on the brink, right? We were on the brink of a financial depression. But, like, we learned from the financial depression that we need to quickly inject stimulus into the economy, and so we did that. And without being an expert in, like, the history of the Federal Reserve, like, kind of staved away like a meaningful amount of depression out of the post 2008 economy. What happened after 2008 is like you see the steady slope upwards of M1 actually accelerate from pre 2008 to post 2008. Then we hit COVID. COVID stimulus was like a different beast in which like everyone's memory goes back to 2008, and we're like, you know what worked in 2008? Stimulus. We're going into COVID. We're going into a pandemic. You know what we should do? Stimulus. Turns out like the COVID crisis and the 2008 crisis were like meaningfully different types of financial crises. And we only really know this in hindsight, but like the COVID crisis didn't necessarily justify the amount of stimulus that we got, but nonetheless, we made that happen. And so like, it's hard to express how vertical the COVID M1 growth line is, but it goes from $4 trillion up to like, what is that? $12, $16 trillion inside of 1 year, like inside of maybe a quarter or two. And so we just quadrupled the M1 supply of money inside of the economy in 2020 because of COVID. And then, like, what happens? We experience inflation for the first time in, like, 30 years. Like, go figure. And then it also continues to rise up until the point where you actually see it come down a little bit, when we all remember the Federal Reserve hiking interest rates for the fastest time since, like, 40 years or something.
Yeah, tightening, right, basically. Tightening. We were doing the opposite of tightening. We were doing massive expansion very quickly in M1, mm-hmm. and then we moved back to tightening. So we've got our M0, we've got our M1. Just wrap a bow on this. How about M2? What does that include?
Yeah, that's just even more derivatives on money. That's even less liquid than M1. This is commercial bank and credit loans. So this is money in money markets. This is money available to banks and financial institutions for lending. So it's money that's been put into a bank, turned into M1, and then it's lent out again to money market funds or other creditors or lenders, creating M2. Still very liquid, but like you have like a couple orders of derivation, which separates it from M0.
Okay, and so the total amount in M2 is 20 trillion. So larger than M1, certainly yeah. significantly larger than M0. So this is how the money that we experience in the typical fiat system, this is essentially how supply, issuance, monetary policy is kind of like managed. So what's the problem with this, David? Or what can be the problem with this? What is the criticism of central banking policy from, let's say, you know, Austrians and those who think that all of this expansion could lead to some disastrous effects?
Yeah, so there's a number of different ways to approach this conversation. First, I would say just like the central bank influences control over like a mass number of people's lives through the levers and dials that they have control over at the Federal Reserve. Like we have all been told that a 2% inflation rate is good and that we should accept that, and that the dilution of our money by 2% every single year is like good for society. That's something that we are just told. There's also since the central bank also kind of influences its control over the commercial banking layer, which is the layer that all like the average Joe has a relationship with. And so it's really just a huge intermediary between you, the individual, the market participant, and the money that you use. And so like when you use the dollar, which is a liability from the Federal Reserve is your counterparty. It is your counterparty on the other side of the transaction of you choosing to store your savings inside of a currency that is managed by the Federal Reserve. So like you as an individual, as a market participant, are giving up some of your sovereignty. Some of your power and influence goes into the manager of your fiat currency. And as we kind of saw with the M1 or the M0, the very erratic nature post 2008, like these are people controlling the lives of like the entire globe, because every transaction, one half of every transaction is fiat currency. And so one half of every transaction has this like one central intermediary, which is the Federal Reserve, and also commercial banks. And when we talk about like living a bankless life or living a being a self-sovereign individual, having a central bank is a obstacle to that, because their choices impact us, and they are humans and they are folly, and they make choices that impact the entire globe.
So this gives a tremendous amount of power to sort of the central bankers around the world to effectively make decisions. Like this is kind of like an issuance tax. Now we're only looking at one side of the equation. So this is not showing us, the demand side for these dollars, mm-hmm. right? This is just the underlying issuance. And since you mentioned it, you mentioned 2% inflation. I think it's important to draw the distinction between what we've been talking about, which is issuance, and inflation. So inflation in itself is just the purchasing power that your unit of currency has, your unit of money has, for some basket of goods. Let's say it's like food, you know, shelter, like energy costs. That is a basket of goods that is sort of defined. And inflation is different than issuance. Okay, so like issuance can spike up, but you might not necessarily feel that in terms of inflation, at least not right away, not immediately, because your purchasing power may not change, right? And so the Fed mandate, it's important to know, when the central bankers around the world are kind of like managing the dials and the knobs for this, they don't really care about issuance. They're not managing to an issuance curve. They're managing to things like unemployment rate in the economy, healthy GDP. They're trying to, at least they say, they're trying to get inflation to a 2% annual range per year. They're not managing to issuance dials. Like, at some level, they don't really care about issuance unless it starts to impact the things that they're really managing, which is like inflation, the overall GDP of the economy, and only then do they actually care. The problem with this, though, David, is that the issuance expansion of supply does tend to manifest in inflation over time. So this is a chart of actual inflation from the early 1900s, so 1913. Over time. So you could see you're starting on this chart with about $10. And if you scroll all the way forward to February 2024, it requires $310 to have the exact same purchasing power of $10 that you had a year ago. Another way to show this chart is sort of like, what's the purchasing power of a consumer dollar from the early 1900s to, you know, the 2020s where we are? The dollar's lost over 97% of its value since, you know, 1913. So if you're holding wealth, at least over the long term, in a dollar, it's basically a shit coin. Like, you're not actually able to hold your wealth over any period of time.
Yeah, and this is something that, like, of course, early Bitcoiners instantiated inside of their culture, which is like, we don't stand for this. In fact, the purchasing power of money ought to go up over time, not down over time. The loss of the value of the dollar came to the benefit of a select few individuals. There's this concept called the Cantillon effect, where the people who are most proximate to the issuance of money benefit the most because they are nearest to the money printer. And so they get to purchase goods before inflation sets in. Actually, they are the cause of inflation because they have this privilege of buying goods before inflation defines other people's value of their savings. And so Bitcoin has always been this reaction to this phenomenon. Like, what if we actually had a supply schedule of our money that was not responding to human incentives or human desires of a select few people? And instead, what if we use this money that stayed stable in supply and in theory would actually grow in value as a function of its demand inside of the economy? And so this is the Bitcoin theory. The Bitcoin idea is like, you just take this little decaying dollar graph and invert it. Whereas the dollar loses money over time, Bitcoin would in theory grow in value over time as a function of the growth of the GDP around Bitcoin.
I think the way that's best expressed, though, is like that's sort of a theory. The practice of that, though, is there's an algorithmic issuance policy. So they look at sort of the Fed M1 and M2 and these spikes and, you know, 12 guys in a room sort of controlling how much money is printed at any specific time. They say, let's get rid of all of that. Let's have a simple algorithmically defined issuance policy. And this is the Bitcoin issuance schedule. Maybe you could kind of define this. So this is a chart that looks much less sporadic, much more calculated, much more planned. It starts at zero, of course, and it ends at 21 million, circa, you know, 2041 or so. This is the Bitcoin issuance schedule. This is the Bitcoin monetary policy. This is essentially Bitcoin M0. What is the M0 calculation, David?
Yeah, so there's a, when you look at this graph, you get a very clear idea. I was like, oh, there's an algorithm happening here. Bitcoin, before I define that algorithm, which is very simple to define, one of the benefits of Bitcoin, like I'll just first state that Bitcoin established the first non-sovereign monetary policy ever. And so back when we were kind of defining monetary policy, like on the human tech tree, you needed both like a government and an army to create and then protect and manage a fiat currency. And this is really the novel institution that Bitcoin created. It has its army. It's called proof of work miners. Mm-hmm. It has its currency. It's called the BTC token, the BTC asset. It has its monetary policy, which is this algorithm, which from 2009 to 2012, the first like 2.5 years of Bitcoin, miners received 50 Bitcoins for every single block that was mined, largely when Bitcoin was like completely valueless. Like, it started to have a value 2011, but people were receiving 50 Bitcoins and they were mining on their CPUs. It was very easy to mine. It was very loose monetary policy at the very, very beginning. And then this supply schedule of Bitcoin is that every 4 years, the issuance of Bitcoin on a per block basis gets cut in half. This is why we call this the halving. So November 2012 was the first halving, reducing the supply of issuance on a Bitcoin basis per block to 25. July 2016, the second halving, 12.5 Bitcoin per block. May 2020, the third halving, 6.25 Bitcoin per block. And then, Ryan, next week, actually, 2024, the next halving will reduce Bitcoin reward per block to 3.125. And then eventually at 2140, we will approach 21 million Bitcoins. And once we hit that 21 million Bitcoins per block, we're done. There will be zero more issuance on a per block basis for Bitcoin. And this is something that you can review and audit the code on in the side of the Bitcoin system. And it has been executing according to that code since the inception of the Bitcoin machine, the Bitcoin system. Unlike the Federal Reserve, which changes, which is why we have FOMC Day. Like FOMC Day is the feds deciding to alerting us issuance. To a change that they're going to change the issuance.
It's their
and that's why part. Everyone pays attention to FOMC.
Yeah. But this is defining code. I like that point you made earlier, which is like, so when you look at sort of monies in the past, we had nature, of course, which really doesn't have, this is nature defined monetary policy, if you can even call it that. Then we had nation states, which is government and army. It's like violence. And now we have algorithmic monetary
Satoshi,
policy.
A human, did create monetary policy in Bitcoin. He just threw away the keys.
Yeah, basically. And it's the crypto economic incentives that actually make this thing go. Another important point to note, of course, there on this chart, we're seeing Bitcoin issuance schedule. This is M0, okay? So there's no notion of M1, M2. Right. The M1 in the Bitcoin economy would essentially be Bitcoin in an exchange, let's say. And so most of the time...
WBTC on Ethereum.
Or wrap Bitcoin on Ethereum. Most of the time, that is not fractional reserve, so it's a one-to-one. So except in cases like FTX, where the Bitcoin wasn't actually
Celsius,
there.
Yeah.
So like, if you put your Bitcoin in Coinbase, that becomes M1, but it's not a fractional reserve system. It's like one Bitcoin in Coinbase for one actual Bitcoin issuance. So it doesn't really affect the total amount of Bitcoin in circulation. All right.
The only reason why it doesn't affect that is because there's kind of this like social contract to, hey, don't fractionally reserve Bitcoin. Because no one wants your fractional reserve Bitcoin.
Well,
we actually kind of consider that.
We've tried
that
a couple times, right? Like, and so what happens is things like BlockFi and like Grayscale and, you know, FTX. And this is why there's this notion of not your keys, not your crypto, is because sometimes banks can go fractionally reserve things behind the scenes. You don't even know. They don't tell you because their ledger is a little bit different. So we did all of that to set up the conversation we're about to have, which is Ethereum's current monetary policy and the changes that are maybe being proposed. Are they being proposed? I'm not sure. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible.
A non-fractional reserve crypto exchange.
Check
if you do not have an account with Kraken, check them out.
If you want a crypto trading experience backed by world-class security and award-winning support teams, then head over to Kraken, one of the longest-standing and most secure crypto platforms in the world. Kraken is on a journey to build a more accessible, inclusive, and fair financial system, making it simple and secure for everyone, everywhere, to trade crypto. Kraken's intuitive trading tools are designed to grow with you, empowering you to make your first or your 100th trade in just a few clicks. And there's an award-winning client support team available 24/7 to help you along the way, along with a whole range of educational guides, articles, and videos. With products and features like Kraken Pro and Kraken NFT Marketplace and a seamless app to bring it all together, it's really the perfect place to get your complete crypto experience. So check out the simple, secure, and powerful way for everyone to trade crypto, whether you're a complete beginner or a seasoned pro. Go to kraken.com/bankless to see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss.
Celo is the mobile-first, EVM-compatible, carbon-negative blockchain built for the real world, driving real-world use cases like mobile payments and mobile DeFi. And with Opera MiniPay as one of the fastest-growing Web3 wallets, Celo is seeing a meteoric rise with over 300 million transactions and 1.5 million monthly active addresses. And now, Celo is looking to come home to Ethereum as a layer 2. Optimism, Polygon, Matter Labs, and Arbitrum have all thrown their hats in the ring for the Celo Layer 2 to build upon their stacks. Why the competition? The Celo Layer 2 will bring huge advantages like a decentralized sequencer, off-chain data availability secured by Ethereum validators, and one block finality. What does that all mean for you? With Celo Layer 2, gas fees will stay low and you can even pay for gas natively using ERC20 tokens, sending crypto to phone numbers across wallets using Social Connect. But Celo is a community-governed protocol. This means that Celo needs you to weigh in and make your voice heard. Join the conversation in the Celo forums. Follow follow Celo on Twitter and visit Celo.org to shape the future of Ethereum.
Mantle, formerly known as BitDAO, is the first DAO-led Web3 ecosystem, all built on top of Mantle's first core product, the Mantle Network, a brand new high-performance Ethereum Layer 2 built using the OP stack, but uses EigenLayer's data availability solution instead of the expensive Ethereum Layer 1. Not only does this reduce Mantle Network's gas fees by 80%, but it also reduces gas fee volatility, providing a more stable foundation for Mantle's applications. The Mantle Treasury is one of the biggest DAO-owned treasuries, which is seeding an ecosystem of projects from all around the Web3 space for Mantle. Mantle already has sub-communities from around Web3 onboarded, like Game7 for Web3 gaming, and Bybit for TVL and liquidity and on-ramps. So if you want to build on the Mantle network, Mantle is offering a grants program that provides milestone-based funding to promising projects that help expand, secure, and decentralize Mantle. If you want to get started working with the first DAO-led Layer 2 ecosystem, check out Mantle at mantle.xyz and follow them on Twitter at 0xmantle.
Ethereum's monetary policy. All right, this is a different curve. Looks a little bit different than Bitcoin, although like not
smooth,
too much
smoothish.
Like if you look at sort of the line over the last, you know, Ethereum's almost 10 years old, so 9 years or so. So what is Ethereum's monetary policy? What has it been? What like changes? What events have occurred? Give us the timeline here in the rundown.
I would actually say Ethereum kind of lacked a monetary policy, and perhaps even like continues to lack a monetary policy to this day. Which is one of the biggest wedges, I would say, defined the difference between the Bitcoin and the Ethereum community. Ethereum started its monetary policy when the blockchain started, which was initial block rewards will be 5 Ether per block, with no future prescriptive nature about any changes in the future or like any sort of model or anything. It's just like, hey, we're going to build this Ethereum thing and we're going to issue 5 ETH a block. During its proof of work phase. And that was as much like kind of thought that went into the whole system. And so Ethereum Genesis block, July 30th, 2015, 5 Ether per block, October 16th in 2017. So a little over 2 years later, it was decided that Ethereum was sufficiently secure and that we should reduce the issuance of Ether. So we went from 5 ETH to 3 ETH. Without really knowing what security is or any sort of like end game target, we just said, hey, like Ethereum, the ETH price went up a lot. We are now issuing a lot of Ether in dollar terms. I think we can afford to like reduce the supply of Ether into the market. So we did in 2017. February 28th was the next one, 2019. The block reward went from 3 to 2. So continuing a reduction of the issuance of Ether, again, without any sort of like rigorous nature. And then in December 1st, 2020, we created the Beacon Chain. So the Beacon Chain was a separate blockchain running in parallel to Ethereum, which would eventually become merged with Ethereum. And this was when this weird phenomenon happened in which we had both the 2 Ether per proof of work block on the proof of work side of things being issued, and then also a marginal increase of Ether being issued because we were also securing the Beacon Chain in proof of stake. I think it was something like of a 3 to 6% increase in total ETH issuance because we had these two chains running in parallel. August 5th, 2021, we introduced EIP 1559 and we started the burn, which is one of the first like opinionated, directional, prescriptive natures about like what should the ETH monetary policy be. We decided that excess fees ought to be burnt. So excess demand of the Ethereum economy, we burn those things. And that started this whole meme around ultrasound money. In 2015, September 15th, 2022, we merged. So we deleted the 2 Ether per block reward on the proof of work chain. And we only had the Beacon Chain issuance, which was much smaller. And so this fulfilled this like idea of ultrasound money. And it was a very constrained issuance algorithm with the burn. And this is actually the moment where ETH went deflationary. So at the moment of the merge, there was more Ether in circulation than there is today. The supply of Ether, it goes up and down because we do issue Ether on the consensus layer, but we burn Ether on the execution layer. This is like, of course, transaction fees. On net, since the merge, the supply of Ether has gone down. I think we have burnt something like 2 or 3 million Ether. That is where things are today. We activated withdrawals, but that actually didn't change the issuance curve of Ether. We activated withdrawals in April of 2023, and that is as things stand.
This is the changes that went into effect.
One add I'd make there, David, maybe it's a quibble, sort of a semantics thing. You said that Ethereum has not had a monetary policy from the very beginning. And I would sort of agree with that, but also disagree. So like when you say it hasn't had a monetary policy, it's always had a monetary policy, but the monetary policy has been soft, let's say. It's been squishy. It hasn't been well-defined. It's not been like the Bitcoin monetary policy, which is we're going to have the supply every 4 years and we're going to end up at 21 million. With Ethereum, it was basically like, we don't know where this thing's going to end. And it was like that in 2015. We're going to add a more precise, calculated, algorithmic monetary policy later, but we don't know how much we should actually be paying for issuance, right? So that is a cost in the network. And of course, in these crypto economic systems, these layer one blockchains that we're building, what does the issuance pay for? It pays for the army, it pays for the economic defense of the entire system. I will say though, since the early days, and this sort of came to be verbalized in the Ethereum community, kind of like the social layer of things that we often on Bankless call kind of like the layer zero that sits beneath all of the chains. At the layer zero, around I would say 2017, 2018, the community started talking about the social contract of the Ethereum monetary policy, which is, as defined, minimum necessary issuance or minimum viable issuance, which basically means we're only going to issue blocks to pay for economic security. So it can't be siphoned away for any other use case because that is the most credibly neutral way to sort of spend our block issuance money. And how much are we going to spend? The minimum necessary to what? Secure the network and keep it decentralized, right? And so if you go back to Satoshi's original 21 million, I'm not sure a lot of thought was given to that number. It's like, what do you think? I mean, he's probably just like, let's just do this every 4 years. You know, the Olympics happens every 4 years, whatever. Every 4 years, we'll just cut it in half. We'll end up at 21 million. Boom. Put it in place. And it hasn't been touched since. That's the difference. Ethereum's has been changed, right? But I'm not sure it went through I'm not sure that Bitcoin's issuance curve had any greater foresight into let me sit and calculate how much economic security Bitcoin needs in the fullness of time. And I come up with this, like 21 million number. That is the answer to all of the problems. Ethereum's just been a bit more gradual. It's been looser and has begun the hardening process, I would say. So the changes more recently have become less drastic, more algorithmic, but it certainly wasn't, it was loose on day one. It is now less so, but it's not completely hardened either.
Well, so the Bitcoin monetary policy, I agree, just didn't really have much thought put into it, kind of by design. Like it was said, hey, a hard cap, 21 million, whatever, 100 million, whatever. So long as we approach a hard cap, then that's kind of the Bitcoin's monetary policy. And it was like simple by design. Like a hard cap is just a pretty simple thing. The only thing left, once you've decided that a hard cap is good, the only thing left to decide is how quickly or slowly that you get there and what kind of curve it takes to get there. What Bitcoin received as a result of that is predictability. Mm. And this is the thing that Bitcoiners love about the Bitcoin monetary algorithm is that like you can just model it out independently and say like, at this particular date on this year, Bitcoin supply will be exactly this. And you will be like within like 98% of a correct answer. The only reason why there's a difference is because the hash rate on Bitcoin changes. With Ethereum, you've never had any sort of predictability. And so you don't really know what the supply of ETH will be at a given moment in future. And so this is kind of the problem with ETH's minimum viable issuance policy. I don't call it like a systemic problem, but like it's a vibe, not an algorithm. And actually, no one really knows what minimum viable is because you don't know what minimum if you are approached a minimum until after your blockchain like gets economically attacked, which is not desirable. So you actually want to have a buffer above a minimum viable to stay away from it because you don't know where it is. And this is one of the big concerns about the Ethereum system is like we have a direction, we have a vibe, but we are still left to be opinionated as to where that vibe is or how close to that vibe we want to go or the choices we want to make to get there.
Well, there's two criticisms that come, I think, from the Bitcoin community when you contrast that with Ethereum monetary policy. One is, you know, predictability, like you say. You can't sort of calculate into the future. I think that's actually less of the concern for many strong fundamental Bitcoiners. I think that is part of the concern. I think the major concern is you can't touch the dials because that's a there's a slippery slope there. Once you start to change things at all, right? So then you introduce some humans that are able to change things. And that destroys the entire, I guess, illusion that like of scarcity of your money, essentially. And I think among very strong Bitcoiners, they would say 21 million is Bitcoin. It can never be changed. If it is ever changed, of course, this is code. So you can hard fork Bitcoin. You could change it to 25 million instead of 21 million. You could you implement a 5% issuance. But the true deciders of what Bitcoin is actually the layer zero, is actually the social community. Who's actually running the Bitcoin software, right? Like between the miners and those that can verify and validate the transactions that the miners put out. Who does the community actually, what does the community actually say is the true code for Bitcoin? And I think for Bitcoiners, some of them don't even acknowledge that the social layer exists. I've had many arguments with them in the past. It's, hey, like it's all, you know, social layer. It's all layer zero at the end stage. There's an Ethereum layer zero with minimum viable issuance. And there's a Bitcoin 21 million, but you're still dependent on those nodes to kind of run the software. But they,
the joke that I like to make about this is that the Bitcoin social contract is that there is no social contract.
Yeah, exactly. Right. We don't talk about it. It's a Fight Club rule.
Still a social contract.
We just don't talk about it. Right. But they're very uncomfortable, let's say, with the tweaks that human beings like core developers are able to make. And like the decision that the community has to make to just, what do we do in the future with respect to issuance? You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think that that kind of defines the differences between Ethereum and Bitcoin. I think Ethereum, the Ethereum vibe about the monetary policy is like Bitcoin directionalism without being Bitcoin precision. And so like we appreciate the idea of like, hey, don't touch the controls. Don't be erratic, be constrained. But we also, as the Ethereum culture say, like, but we need to be pragmatic and we need to make sure that when we like tie our hands to the mast, that we know that we've developed a system that is anti-fragile and resilient.
Yeah.
And that's actually kind of getting to some of the proposals from this ETH monetary update is we are considering the fact that we are not ready as an ETH monetary policy system to tie our hands to the mast and let the system
Don't ossify it too soon has been, you know, part of the social contract. But let me just say some things that would be clearly outside of the social contract, right, of Ethereum. It's like, good luck getting this through, right? Is let's say you increase issuance by like 1% and you delegate that to core devs, for instance. That would be a change that would not go through because that is not encompassing with the minimum necessary issuance. And what would be the check on power to that is the community would rebel. People would not accept that hard fork. It would like not go through the same way that the 21 million mandate is upheld with Bitcoin. So there are some things that are very clearly outside of minimum viable, minimum necessary issuance. Like that, for example. And there's some things that are...
If you wanted to get that change in, you would first have to change the social contract of Ethereum, which is a very hard thing to do.
I think so. Or else what do you end up with, right? This is hard fork, governance, choice lose. You'd have, you know, Ethereum with like a ETH grant and then actual Ethereum, right? It's like it'd be a Ethereum Classic versus, you know, Ethereum Original all over again. So you get kind of a hard fork. So where does that bring, just refresh us now. So you went through this timeline of Ethereum monetary policy and issuance. So where are we now? Like there are some people I think that thought we were at the end of this, right? We did the burn, we did the merge. Okay, we do have some sort of issuance like chart that like, you know, shows what issuance will be in the future. There's some sort of you know, algorithm involved here. Where are we now? Aren't we done? Why aren't we done?
I actually kind of want to go back to this one part of the changing evolution of ETH monetary policy to a part that I'm wondering if listeners caught this as we kind of just, I kind of just glossed over it, which is when we created the proof of stake beacon chain. And then all of a sudden I said like, hey, proof of work rewards are happening. That's 2 Ether per block on the proof of work chain. And then also proof of stake rewards. But like, what's the supply schedule of the proof of stake chain? Because that's actually now the supply schedule of what we now call Ethereum. And so a lot of people kind of like gloss over how this current curve of ETH monetary policy was selected.
That's where the new issuance is happening, you're saying.
Yes, that's where the new issuance is happening. Yes. And so there is this post inside of an ETH research forum called the Beacon Chain Consensus Spec. And it was about the post is signal non-final status of base reward and desired issuance goal. And so this is the Ethereum researchers coming to some sort of equation about the proof of stake chain, which is the current Ethereum chain, and what the issuance should be.
This is back in 2019 is the original date of this post, by the way.
Yeah. So there's this equation that is the current monetary issuance schedule of Ethereum, which is the yield equals 2.6 times 64 over the square root of staked ETH. And that's the curve. That is the equation. And this produces a logarithmic curve. So it starts very high on the y-axis at the very beginning, and then it tapers off very quickly. And then it slowly approaches zero at the end. And the comments on this ETH research post, this forum on GitHub, is pretty interesting. Justin Drake says, below is my rationalization as to why these numbers are reasonable. And then he like targeting 2 to 25 ETH at stake, blah, 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 blah. And then assuming each shard consumes an average of 1,000 ETH in gas per year, blah, 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 with half the gas burn, blah, 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 then inflation would be about 0.5% and the validator return would be 5%. Feels healthy, exclamation point.
Yeah.
Which is like the level of rigor that went into this thing. Is like, true. Justin like did some napkin math, and I've seen Justin do napkin math before. He's generally directionally correct.
It's probably the same napkin math though that Satoshi did. It was like,
probably, yeah.
Let's have it every 4 years. End up at 21. Feels healthy. Feels like it could work. But like,
Bitcoin gets that luxury because as long as they approach a hard cap, like mission accomplished.
Right.
Right. Like Ethereum doesn't have that same luxury because that's just not what our vibe is. The emphasis I want to place on this is like Justin Drake did these like three sentences of napkin math and then says feels healthy at the very end. John Adler, if you scroll down, he quotes feels healthy and goes, that doesn't seem like a particularly rigorous metric. Neither does that this other blockchain has X issuance rate and they haven't gone intact yet. So X must be fine. Why not outsource the task to an independent panel of actual economists? And so this is actually a question I have for you, Ryan. When we merged to proof of stake and enabled withdrawals, did you think that we were done with ETH monetary policy? Like, what did you think about ETH monetary policy at the time? Were we like hands off? We were ready to go. This is going to be it. Or like, we're going to have to change. What did you think about like the conclusion of ETH monetary policy once we went proof of stake and merged?
I mean, I think it started off in like, you know, 2015, 2016. It was more like, it was just like a liquid. It was just kind of like, water sloshing about or something like that. And then slowly it's hardened over time. And so like maybe, you know, 2018, it became like a jello type form, but I didn't feel like it was fully like concrete. There was still some hardening left to do. And so I felt like maybe there could be like one more, like maybe two, mm-hmm. but the changes would have to be like much more slight, you know, not really affecting very much. I mean, it could be other burn mechanisms that we introduce, for instance, sure. But it would have to be in the spirit of minimum necessary, minimum viable issuance, and like wouldn't be a major change that would affect everything. So just not fully ossified, but real close, getting real close.
Yeah. I remember thinking even before we merged, there was never any sort of conversation about the ETH issuance curve out in public. It never really reached, I never heard about it really. And so like when we did the whole merge thing, I was like, you know, where did we decide? Where was the conversation about ETH monetary policy? Where did those numbers come from? And like my intuition was, because I didn't hear about it as like an external Ethereum community member, I kind of just assumed exactly what ultimately happened, which is just like we licked our fingers, stick it up in the air, felt the wind, and be like, that's the vibe.
It's just not that different than what Satoshi probably did. It's just because you don't see how the sausage is made with Satoshi, mm-hmm. and it's shrouded in this mystery of a pseudonymous founder who just like kind of like set the ship in the direction and just kind of like left. Then like that feels like it has much more narrative, I guess, legitimacy in terms of setting the policy, then looking like you can actually see it in this link in GitHub, and you kind of like see how it came to be.
Right.
You see the inside baseball. You see how the sausage is made.
Yeah. And so like always in the back of my head, I've always been like, there's going to be one more, because we did a bunch of unrigorous policy changes, directional, you know, self-correcting policy changes. But like in order to actually like tie our hands to the mast on one of Ethereum's most important pillars, which is its monetary policy, its security, like we need rigor and debate. And because we kind of just like glossed over that conversation when we picked that curve in proof of stake, I always in my mind was like, there's gonna be one more, like we're not done
yet. It felt like the network's not done yet, right? Like not all of the economic agents have entered, like in particular like layer twos. We're just on the cusp of these massive chains starting to consume Ethereum block space, or just staking is new and liquid staking is new, and now Eigenlayer has entered the picture.
So much data left to connect.
We don't even have an Ethereum ETF in the U.S., right? So the institutions haven't even entered. So how are these economic players going to end? One other thing I'll just mention is a massive disadvantage in having a hard cap and saying like 21 million is you actually, we pointed this out in the kind of like the earlier days of Bankless, is you actually don't know if that economic security is going to be enough to provide the level of like settlement that your layer one actually needs, right? So Bitcoin block rewards drop down to zero, and will transaction fees be enough to pay for a decentralized global settlement layer? Like uncertain, but it feels like wow, that's a pretty big risk.
They've already tied their hands to the mast though, so they're going to find out.
Right. They're going to find out. Whereas Ethereum can be a bit more, they can sort of weight the decisions over time and let all of the economic agents kind of enter before they fully ossify. So that brings us to the conversation that we are having right now.
We are finally here. 50 minutes into this episode, we are finally arriving at modern times.
So what is this? What is the debate? Right. What is the actual proposal? Why do we even need, why is anyone even proposing that we need to change issuance in any way?
So Ansgar and Casper from the Ethereum Foundation, these are researchers from the Ethereum Foundation, released this ETH research blog post called Endgame Staking Economics, A Case for Targeting. And so importantly, endgame, rather than like, the Ethereum culture has, I don't know if you noticed this, but like started to replace this word ossification with endgame. And so like we're actually kind of removing ossification from our vernacular and kind of replacing it with endgame more and more and more. And so like this is the attempt to discover the end game issuance curve for Ether's monetary policy. And importantly, this thing is they're calling for a case for targeting. What's targeting? Targeting is basically trying to find a particular percent of Ether supply that is staked to Ethereum and targeting that number by putting bounds on the left and the right side of that target.
Okay. Can I just understand that? So like that is what they're trying to target is percent of ETH staked. They are not trying to target issuance. They're not trying to, there's just over 120 million Ether in circulation. And that number can go up. It can go down based on like rewards versus burn. They don't really care about that number. That's not the metric that they are targeting. What they care about is percent of ETH staked. And right now it's around like what? Between 25 and 30%, something like that?
Yeah, it's like just over 25%, but it has been increasing up only ever since inception.
Okay. And so Ansgar and Casper, if I understand the contours of this proposal, they think it's a bad thing for Ethereum to go too high in terms of percent of ETH staked. So a bad scenario would be like 90-95% ETH staked. Like anything that is directionally close to that is bad. And around, you know, like 25 to 30%, 35, 40, like that feels like a safer zone. And so that's what when you say targeting, that's the thing that they're targeting. Yes.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. And they also make an argument that like if we get higher than 50% ETH staked, I'm not sure, I don't think this is in the blog post, so I might be putting words in their mouth, but the vibe is that like once you approach some like pass some equilibrium, like once you pass 50% of ETH staked, the difference between 50% and 100% of ETH staked is not the equivalent of between 0 and 50%. Like once you hit 50%, like there's kind of a magnet at the 100% end. and you very quickly approach 100%, and it's very hard to reverse that for all the incentives of ETH staking.
So that's the reason that they're bringing this up before we cross these thresholds where it becomes right. harder and harder to kind of go back. Can we just, like, why? Why does it matter what percent of ETH staked? Like, why is 90% a mm-hmm. bad thing, according to Casper and Onskar? What reasons do they give?
There's a number of different reasons. Maybe I'll kind of start by defining the differences between solo staking and staking service providers, what we would call LSTs. LSTs like Lido, Rocket Pool, you know, Stakewise, and now even LRTs, liquid restaking tokens, do a very similar thing, if not more. They reduce the cost to stake. Do you hold any like RETH or like staked ETH,
yes.
Ryan?
Yes.
How costly in terms of your time, energy, and capital was it to trade your ether for that staked ETH?
Incredibly simple. Easier for like than technically running a solo staker, right. Of course. There's just some associated risk. But there's also, for me, right. It's like there's risk in running a solo staker as well. But very, very right. easy from a, like, just click a button.
And also, if you were to solo stake your ether, you would not get staked ETH or RETH in return.
It's not liquid, you mean?
So it's not liquid, exactly. And so the incentive to use a liquid staked token is high because you get liquidity on your staked ETH. The cost of staking with a liquid staked token is very low. It's like 10% of your yield for Lido. But then you also don't have to run your own node. These professional operators are doing it for you. And so you actually like unburden yourself and you just pay, you know, 10% fee to the Lido system. And so the costs of solo staking are like high because you can't restake and you have to run your own node. You get some fees back, but really this is all compression of fees anyways. Like all these liquid staking providers are all competing on fees. And so by making it so incredibly easy to stake with a service provider, we are basically assuming that the supply of staked ETH is going to approach 100% because the curve of ETH, the ETH monetary policy, is logarithmic. It approaches, it marginally decreases in yields for the higher percent of ETH stake, but there's no real mechanism to prevent it from going to 100. And this is true for like all of the LSTs. Now we have LRTs doing token incentives. Like 3/4, I think, of all newly deposited ether into the beacon chain is going into Eigenlayer. And so this is an external force on yield on ether that's coming from outside of the protocol. So even that is pushing ether into being liquid staked ether, into being liquid restaked ether.
Okay.
So the argument is that solo staking is fundamentally losing to staking service providers simply because of the dynamics of the supply curve.
Okay. And why is that bad? Why is it bad to... So basically, one of the arguments here is this would result... Like, if we don't change something, we'll have fewer solo stakers, and that is a bad thing for the network. Is this the argument, and why?
Not just fewer solo stakers. That's one thing, and I think that's important. But also, let's go back to what we were talking about with the Federal Reserve. We actually have a removal of M0 money from the Ethereum ecosystem, and we almost in a 100% LST staked world, we actually only have M1 money. And this is actually starting to get into one of the my motivations for this episode, because I actually think Bankless has a position here. M1 money is intermediated money.
Right.
It is
banked.
Banked money. It's banked money.
Right.
And so Lido,
or it's
like,
more
even
banked
Rocket,
on the spectrum.
It's more banked.
Yes.
It's more banked. Even Rocket Pool, which is like non-custodial and permissionless, is still intermediated by smart contracts, which have smart contract risk. And so this current Ether monetary schedule, this curve, actually does not protect vanilla Ether. So it's actually one thing to talk about the protection of solo stakers, which I think is totally noble, and we should definitely consider that. I also think even more, much more critically, this is a conversation protecting raw vanilla Ether, the M0 of Ethereum.
Base money, basically.
Base money, yeah, of Ethereum. And so the idea of constraining the supply of ETH staked is in protection of base money. It's it's a boon to the value of raw Ether at the cost of staked Ether in terms of value.
So let me see if I can kind of connect those dots of why it's bad to have all of the Ether inside of M1 rather than M0. Mm-hmm. So we're basically saying if you move from Ether to like Lido staked ETH, you're moving from M0 to M1 without realizing. The same way if you put cash in an ATM, inside an ATM and it goes in a bank account, well, you've just converted your M0 into M1. You have sort of a set of bankers that you're kind of dealing with. Now, there are levels of like what we mean by bankers, right? With Rocket Pool, it's much more decentralized. You're trusting some smart contracts, that sort of thing.
There's actually no banker in the Rocket Pool system. There's just smart contracts.
Right. With Lido,
the smart contracts are the bank, which we are generally cool with.
With Lido, you have some smart contract risk and then a permission set of validators, which maybe that'll decentralize over time. And then also you have kind of like a Lido governance token, which is, again, that's another layer of something, some sort of intermediary.
Some intermediary.
It could be light intermediary. Maybe it's acceptable, but it's not as pristine as M0.
Right.
And then if you go to the extreme case where you have an exchange doing this, the staking like a Kraken or Coinbase or something, well, that is purely, you know, CETH on Coinbase, for example, that is purely banker intermediated ether. And imagine if that was 90% of all ETH supply was staked inside of CETH. Well, if like an exchange founder goes wrong, if you get another Sam Bankman-Fried on the scene, they decide to fractionalize that ether reserve, then they can kind of do that, and there can be all sorts of shenanigans, and we're left with the same system that we left, where you have banker intermediated money. I guess it's sort of a tail wag the dog type of scenario as well, where it's just like the protocol loses power to the banker cabal.
Taking self-custody of your crypto is one of the most important things you can do on your bankless journey. It's also one of the hardest things to get right, with huge consequences if you don't. If you want help going bankless, talk to Casa. Casa helps you take custody of your crypto assets so you don't have to wonder whether you're doing it right. Casa is a one-stop shop for doing self-custody the right way. With Casa Vaults, you can hold Ether, Bitcoin, stablecoins, all with one simple app and multiple keys for the ultimate peace of mind, with a support team to help you every step of the way. But it doesn't stop at self-custody, because even though crypto is forever, you are not. We all plan on making life-changing wealth in crypto, but with Casa's inheritance product, life-changing wealth can elevate to generational wealth for your kids and your loved ones who don't know anything about crypto. With Casa, you won't lose your private keys and you won't accidentally take them to the grave either. Click the link in the description to get started securing your generational wealth. Launching a token? Don't let complex legal and tax issues slow you down. Toku provides specialized support to optimize your launch and ensure that you as a founder and your team and your investors get the most tax-efficient outcomes. The Toku team understands the crypto space inside and out and will ensure your token launch is fully compliant while maximizing tax efficiency. Toku can connect you with the best attorneys if you need them to make sure that you have the best advice, and Toku can help to optimize your taxes so you pay the least possible amount of taxes while still maintaining legal compliance. With Toku's guidance, you can concentrate on building your company while Toku handles the logistics. Token launches don't have to be complicated. Talk to Toku today to get a free initial token valuation.
Right. Let's open up the image here where we have the three different options for the ETH supply curve, because I think we can do a little bit better to explain what these what targeting is. I'll do my best to explain this for the podcast listeners. So we're looking at three different graphs, three different supply curves of Ether, the asset. We have on the left, we have the current supply curve, which is, like I said, it's the yield to staking Ether is very high if there is not very much Ether being staked. And then as more Ether is staked, that yield comes down pretty rapidly at the beginning, and then it kind of just marginally gets closer to zero. But there's also a meaningful buffer between zero and the actual yield. So like you kind of always will receive, even when there's 100% ETH staked, I think at 100% ETH staked, all ETH staked gets about like 2.2% yield. And so that's the current supply of things. And so that's one of the main reasons why there's this magnet in the current state of the Ethereum monetary policy, why there's this magnet approaching 100% ETH staked, because even at 100% ETH staked, everyone gets 2% who's staking their ETH. Now, the thing is that like I said, above 50%, really the incentive to stake your Ether doesn't come from the fact that Ethereum needs more security. It's actually motivated by removing yourself from dilution, like avoiding dilution, which isn't a good reason to actually have 100% ETH staked. So minimum viable issuance is somewhat similar to like minimum viable security. Like, we actually don't want Ethereum to overpay for security. We don't want Ethereum to be over secure. It should be at a Goldilocks zone. It's kind of like one of the social contracts of Ethereum is like, find the Goldilocks. And so this, by having like 2% for all stakers, even at 100% stake rate, really penalizes raw ETH and basically invalidates its ability to exist. So that's the current state of things. And that's the left side curve. We have two options that is proposed in Ansgar's and Casper's research post, which is option one, which is the smaller of the two changes.
Less aggressive.
Which is less aggressive. Thank you. Which is take the exact same supply curve that we have and just lower the issuance. And so don't change the curve, just lower the total amount of ether being issued. And so at 100% ETH staked, actually there's zero issuance. And so you actually severely disincentivize the power of that magnet to approach 100%. And so this assumes that there will be some sort of equilibrium discovered before we ever get to 100%, where just like the total issuance of Ethereum approaches zero as we approach 100% stake.
To kind of slow things down, you put the brakes on just, somewhere between exactly. The process, mm-hmm. like between the 25% of ETH staked and like the 90% like red zone. You're just kind of slowing that incentive down.
That's exactly right. Like, don't change the actual curve, just reduce the total supply of Ether being issued to also reduce the incentive to create M1 money at the cost of M0 money.
Okay.
And then there's the more aggressive response, which is actually let's add a new mechanism. Let's change the shape of the curve to make this curve become extremely aggressively avoiding 100%. And so this is like, so instead of like having a smooth log curve that's kind of basically just like, you know, shaped like a rounded L, it is an S curve. And so you have a very steep drop off at the very beginning, as we do now. That mechanism stays the same. It highly incentivizes ETH to become staked at the very beginning of the curve where there's not much ETH staked. So it very strongly incentivizes higher than zero ETH staked. And so there's a very high yield to go from like zero to like 10 million ETH staked, which is exactly what it is today. And then there's a target. I call it like 25 million or 25% of all ETH staked, where that is the flattest part of the curve. But then when we start to get 30, 45%, 50%.
And you're making these numbers up. That's not necessarily, but whatever the target is, insert your percentage target.
I'm trying to like illustrate the shape of the curve.
Okay.
Yeah. Once you get a higher than the target, then the issuance of yield drastically decreases and actually goes negative.
Negative yield?
And so negative yield. And so think of trying to, for the podcast listeners, a very vertical line that drops, that approaches zero very, very quickly at the very beginning, starts to become more horizontal and reaches its maximum level of horizontalness at the target. And then as it gets further away from the target being like 25%, as it gets further away from the target, it starts to go back vertical, continuing downwards. So it's like a sideways S that starts high and ends very low and actually drops off at the bottom because it goes negative. And so what this is doing is this is adding an opinion, adding a mechanism beyond the target that reduces ETH issuance and even allows it to go negative. And so what this would look like is that if you are staking your ether when there is negative issuance, you're staking your ether and you're actually having ether taken away from you. If you are staking,
so you have
your
like
ether.
32 ETH in your validator and you're expecting to receive some profit, but if it switches into negative issuance mode, then you're actually ETH every like block taken away from you basically, and that that gets burnt, I would assume, it just goes somewhere.
It would just get deleted. And like that, it may be that on intuitively, like as a gut reaction, and people are like, well, that's crazy. Why would you do that? Well, like think about the incoming yields from Eigenlayer. What if the negative interest rates of Ethereum is like negative 2%? So you are losing 2% every single year inside of the protocol.
But
you're actually receiving 8% inside of Eigenlayer. And so you are net positive due to the external forces around Ethereum that's extra to the protocol. But the protocol constrains and protects itself by penalizing people inside of the chain who are staking beyond a particular target.
It's interesting how you frame this. And you say you're inserting an opinion by adding kind of this target and the negative rate. And I'll say, yes, you're inserting an opinion, but we already have an opinion here, right? Which is the current shape of the curve, which kind of diminishes over time, is actually an expressed opinion already. Yeah. And we could keep that opinion relatively the same, except just like modify it slightly, or like, I guess change the opinion at a more fundamental level and add like kind of like negative issuance. But I guess, you know, the current approach that we have is already an opinion. It's important to note that. It's just an opinion that we've been used to because we've had it in place for the last like 3 years. Okay, so this is what they're proposing. And the idea, I guess the...
Well, so maybe just to really clarify what they're proposing.
Okay.
They have created a proposal to include option one, the less aggressive change, into Electra, the next hard fork, which in the Ethereum context is like aggressive already.
Just like,
it's like you guys are changing the supply curve. We're slapping this thing in. And this is why there's controversy, is kind of the speed and the haste in which option one, the less aggressive curve, the one without the second new opinion, is being added into.
That's why people are actually upset. They're like, okay, well, now you're trying to do this option one. We haven't had time to kind of like weigh in, give this some thought, and like you're trying to like put this in a hard fork. Now, when I
to be clear, this is not consensus. So by default, this is not going into the hard fork. They are just proposing that it does go into
this. This gets into another separate podcast I don't want to do right now, which is like, how does a bill become a law? You know,
Ethereum rough consensus? I don't want to do that podcast.
Yeah. How does an EIP actually get, it's a messy process. Right. Let's just say that. And you can't just create a research post and like propose it for next hard fork and suddenly it's there. Like, this is the process of the community kind of vetting it. The other thing I've heard, Ansgar and Casper like actually talk about this. And I think they're not like forcefully pushing this. They're very much wanting to have the discussion with the community. Yep. In order to provoke that discussion, this is what you have to do. You have to write a post
you have to provoke it.
And you actually have to like poke a little bit. And you have to be like, this option one could be ready for the next Ethereum hard fork. What do you say? And so at some level, this is exactly the conversation that the Ethereum community kind of should be having, I guess. Okay, so...
One of the arguments that they make is that because we are in the shape that we have, there is no constraint on the total supply of ETH staked. And so one of the reasons why they are being aggressive with it is that they, like you said, are provoking it. But as we approach, 40% staked, 50% staked, 60% staked, it makes it harder to go back down to a lower number.
Because you have some incumbents, right?
Yeah, you have incumbents. Like, well, you're already there, right? There's literally Ether in the beacon chain. And so getting it back out is like a whole other step. And so one of the arguments is that the quicker that we can do this, the less painful it is on net because it's less self-correcting.
Well, fewer incumbents, fewer existing projects have like sort of based their entire ecosystem around the assumptions of the current curve, right? I was just even thinking our conversation with Blast and Pac-Man, right? He built an entire layer two based on ETH stake yield. What happens if that goes in the negative direction? A lot of downstream effects on the business model for that entire layer too, I would imagine, right? And so like this type of thing, the longer it exists, is going to be harder to change. And so I guess with option one and option two, the entire idea is to target a lower percent of ETH staked. And in doing so, the protocol has greater control than kind of like the smart contracts and banking layer that's kind of built on top of it. And we have more base money, and that keeps Ethereum, the argument would go, that keeps Ethereum more quote unquote decentralized. But the contrast with that, right, is because what I hear from, and I think Bankless is fully subscribed to this, we want Ether to be a monetary unit. We want it to be money. We sort of like been talking about that for like a long time. I think most of the community now agrees with this, including Ansgar and Casper. And their argument for a proposal like the options that they laid out is, if Ether is going to be a global permissionless money, then M0 has to be very strong, right? We can't have everything turn into M1, right? And then the other side of the debate is also people who believe and want Ether to be money, a monetary unit. They say, well, the more times you tweak the algorithm for this and the supply curve, we have to go back to like factory reset. We have to go back to day zero. And we have to say, well, it's been how many days since the Ethereum algorithm was actually tweaked? Right. And it opens up a layer or a narrative hole for people to say, hey, a few core devs can kind of change issuance at every time. See, you just did this in like the Electra hard fork in 2024. And what's to say you're not going to do it in another year or two, and you'll keep changing it over time. So we're all ETH is money people, right? Is that the question of, what side of the debate do you fall in? Is this worth weighing in on?
I think that particular argument is actually relatively weak. I think you and I, as children of 2016, 2017, Ethereum, this is when we learned about Ethereum. That particular context of Ethereum's era was marked by Bitcoiners like bullying us about that exact point. And they've also like never really been right about
what
that.
What you mean, like, changing? Yeah, so, like anytime you change it is a bad for your
just
money.
Like Ethereum is a shit coin because it's no different from the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Like literally Anthony Pompliano tweeted this out one time. It's like, ETH is no different from the Federal Reserve. They change the monetary policy all the time. And like it was always just like not really representative of truth. Like they don't change the monetary policy all the time. It happened like four times. And it most importantly, it was always to the reduction of ETH supply. And I'm very happy with the history of ETH monetary policy. I think we've made the right choices through and through and through. And so I'm less inclined on like breaking the Lindy of the current state of ETH monetary policy.
Think that there's a sense of mysticism here that's like, it's kind of the emperor, like with no clothes. There's something about money that is mystical. It's like high priest, like Satoshi has to devise this perfect algorithm and then like disappear. And who knows why it's 21 million, why it's not something else. Like, do you think that the illusion of money starts to use its actual monetary process, since all it is a shared story? If you start to erode the actual story and people see that it's just a, you know, like some people writing code that actually created the monetary policy?
I think the other side of the story is stronger. Notably, both options here decrease the total issuance of Ether. So both option one and option two lower the issuance of Ether. Both of them increase the moneyness of Ether. And so everything's a trade-off. We are changing the monetary policy one more time.
Potentially.
But every single policy change ever made to Ethereum to this day, historically, has always reduced the supply of Ether, except for the one caveat when we made the Beacon chain and we actually added issuance because of the proof of stake chain and parallel. But people just accepted that because it fit the story of Ethereum and it made sense. And these two options both reduce the total issuance of Ether, increase the value of base money. And so I think that side of the story is much more powerful than just like the Ethereum. It's not just the core devs. Like,
oh, so you do have an opinion on this. You like these options, or you like the direction of these options.
If one of these options increased the supply of Ether, increased the issuance, I would have much stronger reservations.
It's outside of the... The social contract of minimum.
Both options are inside the social contract of minimum viable issuance.
Do you think that these options strengthen the monetary properties of Ethereum? It's like, and
massive.
You do. Okay. But yeah. Would you also concede that from a narrative perspective, they first weaken it in the short run because you're injecting yet another change that the core devs have proposed? So in the short run, it weakens it. But in the long term, you think it strengthens it?
I think it weakens it, sure, technically, marginally so, but I don't think it weakens it all that much. Like, I think the costs of changing the monetary policy of ETH are low.
And
the benefits that we get from this change are
and
high.
Do you also believe that there should actually be an end game? Or is it, so, like, yes, here's another slippery slope argument. It's like, yeah, sure, it's always one more change, right? Like, there's always another end game beyond the end game, and so... You've called this the end game, and then you'll come up with another term for a new end state, you know, and want to change this again 2 years. Like, are you on team that monetary policy actually should ossify at some point and there should be an end game?
I think option two is the most credible path to an end game Ethereum, Ether, monetary policy, economics. And this is in the title of the blog post. It's titled End Game Staking Economics, a Case for Targeting. Notably, option one is not an end game to me. And option one, which is the keep the same supply curve, just lower the total issuance, buys us time to get to option two, which is the end game. To be my own devil's advocate, like a failure scenario here is we choose option two. Say we choose 25% ETH targeting, and then we actually learn that we approached minimum viable issuance and actually went too far, and we're actually less than viable issuance, and we're like, oh shit, too far. We actually have to increase issuance because we went too far. That's like the bad case scenario. But I think we can 25% is just a number I made up. We can research that number. Maybe it's 33%. Maybe it's 40%. I don't know. I think that we have plenty of tolerance here to choose a number that's healthy, and that it will be sufficiently secure. And that the option two is the most credible path to choosing a monetary policy that we will never, ever have to touch again.
Okay. So this is the first time we've ever discussed this, by the way. Yeah. So I'm just kind of like formulating. That's your opinion. Then.
I am telling my opinion right now for the first time.
So do you want to hear my opinion?
Sure.
I think option two is not off the table and could be a final like negative issuance resting rate. I could be on board with something like option one that is much more moderate, but overall, I feel like it's too soon to do something as drastic as option two. Potentially option one, maybe not this year hard fork, but maybe the next. And the reason I say I feel like it's too soon is because the full range of economic agents that we'll see in the future have not yet entered Ethereum in force. Right. So we are just at the early outset of figuring out like what restaking is going to look like. And that could be a massive force, economic force inside of Ethereum's like monetary considerations. We don't have an Ether ETF. We have no idea how much Ether the institutions are actually going to like, you know, slurp up and what it looks like when a BlackRock with X percent of Ether starts to flex its muscle and say, we are now staking, right? Like what kind of ripple effects will that have on preserving this? So I guess what I'd say is it's just soon. I'm glad we're having this conversation. I worry about making a drastic decision. Option one is not that drastic, so I could sort of see the case for it, but I'm not necessarily sure that option one is like enough of a change that it's worth it to actually like open the door and change monetary policy yet again. I'd rather like, you know, measure twice, cut once is kind of my gut take on this.
I think that you are being reactive, which is totally fine, really legit. You're being reactive to what is going to be incoming data from future phenomenons. I think my position is that we actually have sufficient data that we ought to do something now, because we actually do have informed hypotheses about what's going to happen in the near term, which is like, well, what do you think? We haven't, Eigenlayer's not live yet. We haven't seen yield from AVS, but I'm sorry. What do you think is going to happen? More ETH is going to be staked.
I see what you're saying.
Don't want that.
I see. So I think actually, and
we have the data.
I think that's kind of a valid point, right? Which is basically what you're saying is we know what we want, which is we don't want 100% of Ether being staked inside M1 type vehicles, right? Or anything close to that. And we know we want to preserve an M0 base money on Ethereum, right? And in order to do that, we can't have like 60, 70, 80, 90% of ETH like staked. And so like, we know what the effect the pulls are. We have basically a target rate, and so we should go ahead and do that. I think there's merit in that case. What I would say though is the Ethereum community is actually not necessarily on board with that yet. Like I think we're still in the phase of the advocates for something like option two or even option one, quite frankly, still have to make the case to everyone in the entire Ethereum ecosystem that like. We should actually strive to have a target rate for percent of Ether staked. And I've seen parts of that argument, but I haven't seen that argument like strongly put, let's say, and to be compelling enough to get the vast majority of Ethereum ecosystem participants on board. And you also have counter, like Lido would not want that, right? Like I think you've heard Hasu's.
Oh, yeah. No, Lido wants 100% e-stake. There have been tweets from the Lido team advocating for it.
Sure, and this like, is this, want- this. But Hasu also has said. I mean, we had an entire podcast about this. He said, "Yeah, 100% ETH staked. Like you're going right. against gravity." It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. And so I feel like in order to do something like option one or option two, you have to have more debate, more consensus, more justification, more like. There should be X percent of ETH staked, and it's obvious because of these reasons. Because otherwise, it feels a little bit, feels a little bit Prog Powy. For people who don't know, that's a deep cut reference.
There's a lot of listeners who don't know about Prog Pow, and I don't want to.
Just the entire community is not bought into even the idea of a target ETH rate right now.
Right. So Prog Pow, progressive proof of work, was this proposed change to the Ethereum hashing algorithm back in our proof of work days. If I remember correctly, it was very, it was interested by the miners. The miners were interested in it because it would brick ASICs. And I think this is right. It would brick ASICs and it would be a boon to individual GPU operators. So like back in my GPU mining days, that would have been a boon to me. And it would have been a penalty.
There'd be winners and losers. And basically, core devs would get to decide kind of who they are, basically, right? In the miner community. Yeah. Never went through, but it was very controversial.
The reason this is a side quest, you know what happened actually, why I didn't go through? Because COVID fucked up the supply chains of the ASICs. And so the Prog Pow fears of ASICs incoming actually went away because COVID ended.
I was against it, by the way. I just thought it was stupid.
Most of the community was against
it. I thought it was stupid because we're doing staking anyway. Why are we messing with mining?
That was also the argument.
You know, it became a non-issue, obviously, because we transitioned to staking.
So as we go forward in this debate as to like what do about the supply of ETH staked, I want to call into attention option two, the more aggressive one, which preserves vanilla raw ether inside of the Ethereum economy. And I kind of want to put this into contrast of like many of the startups, including the ones that you and I are invested in both as angels and through Bankless Ventures. And these are like organizations like Lido, any LRT project. Do you have staked ETH inside of like DeFi?
Yeah.
I have staked ETH.
If you're a validator, you have like a lot of people have vested interests in this, is what you're saying.
Right.
And not changing
so like,
this.
There's a lot of people with vested interests who want Ether to go into their project before touching the end consumer. And if we can target, if we target like 25% of ETH staked, it is a boon to raw vanilla ETH. It is a boon to like the long tail of Ethereum, to the average Joe who doesn't have to think about or kick the tires of every single like staking project, of which I think we also want many of them. And so there's like negative ETH yields. So like the net effect of ETH yield is like 10% because of eigenlayer AVSs, because of the LRT incentives, et cetera. And so as a result of that, there is negative 3% inflation inside of the Ethereum beacon chain. And ETH stakers are just eating that negative inflation because they're getting yield from external forces, the external startups, like the LRT startups, the eigenlayer startups. Maybe you're just like Joe Schmo, average retail guy who doesn't want to be beholden to any LRT or doesn't want to have their ETH and eigenlayer just to stay, just to remove themselves from dilution. And so raw ETH gets, it's deflationary because of MEV burn, or because of EIP 1559 is burning.
Just hold raw ETH.
It's also deflationary because all of the people yield maximizing are receiving negative inflation from the Ethereum protocol. And so maybe you just want to F off and not think about any VC-backed startup, any LRT, any like LST dominance is trying to eat into like 100% of market share. Maybe you just want to hold our ETH and you don't want to have to be intermediated by some startup. And so this, I think, is it's very Bankless aligned, in my opinion, to have option two because it preserves the M0 of Ethereum, ETH. It disintermediates the Ethereum economy significantly in the ETH context. And I think it's just like beneficial to the margins, which is always what crypto and Ethereum's always been about.
Yeah. I mean, there's things I'm not fully on board. I don't know yet. I'm definitely open. I don't know about the option. There are certainly some things that are like within ethos to sort of support, right? So, you know, like widest set of participants is always going to be ETH holders. The ability to have my private key in a self-sovereign way. And for that to be a monetary unit that is useful is like incredibly important. That is the widest set of possible participants in this decentralized network. So strengthening that makes sense. M0 being strong, strengthening Ethereum's monetary capabilities, monetary effects make sense. Solo stakers being a valuable participant in this network, that is essential to how this operates as well. There's a lot to like, I think, about these concepts. I just don't know if this specific implementation is going to deliver on all of these things or if it's practical. But I guess that is the debate that is going to...
Right, that is the debate. There's like the very concrete, here are the parameters debate, and then there's also the vibe debate. And the vibe debate is what we're seeing on screen here, like these three different options.
Interesting.
My vibe is option two, firmly.
Firmly? You ready to firmly call option that? Man, two. You are. Yes, I guess I'll be breaks again. It's like... I like the concept. Let's have more discussion about it. Good, though. I feel like I understand what's going on. And the wider context. And Bankless listener, we hope you do as well. Should we end with risks and disclaimers, David?
Let's do it.
All right. Of course, David and I hold some ETH, so we have a vested interest in this network being successful. And you guys know crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.